Hello and welcome to the Local Myth Story and Podcast with me, Eli Lewis Lycett. In this episode, we're over in the Staffordshire Moorlands, an area that featured heavily in season one of the podcast. But this is the story of Thomas Meekin's 18th century murder, a well-known legend locally as the boy who was buried alive. Yet there's never before been a full consideration of the circumstances surrounding his death, nor any inquiry into who may have killed him. Sat atop a gentle hillside in Rushton Spencer, the Church of St. Lawrence quietly looks down on the world below it, mostly unnoticed and rarely noted upon by the drivers of the hundreds of cars that travel by on the A523 between the towns of Leek and Macclesfield every day of the year. For those that do take the time to give it a cursory glance and then go on to inquire into its history, its most notable feature will probably be the fact that it's managed to retain its medieval timber framing within the 17th century sandstone exterior that guards it against the elements. It should come as no surprise, really, that few outside the village of Rushton Spencer are even aware of this little gem of a church. After all, this is a place referred to in the historical record as the Chapel in the Wilderness. Yet in truth, as with many of our oldest churches, St. Lawrence's has been witness to many events across its lifetime, the most curious of all being that of the murder of Thomas Meekin. His story is something of a fireside standard in the local area. A local boy moves away to the Staffordshire town of Stone to act as a stable boy, only to fall in love with his master's daughter, suddenly take ill and die. He's buried, but rumours of foul play emerge, not least due to the insistence of his favourite pony wandering out at night to kick at the earth of his grave. Upon exhumation, it appears that when Thomas went into the ground, he was not dead at all, and so he is returned for reinterment in his home village of Rushton Spencer, memorialised for eternity by his west-facing headstone beneath the yew trees that reads, "As a man falleth before wicked men, so fell I." Now that's the story in a nutshell, but as with so many such local tales, it's been passed down to us without a great deal of inquiry. First and foremost, it's a tale of sorrow, but the murderous intrigue and supernatural tilt contained within the detail of the piece leave plenty of areas to explore. Not least of all, just who killed Thomas Meekin? Born in Rushton Spencer around 1760 to Mary and Thomas Meekin, the road ahead would likely have played out itself much in the way that it did for many in such rural spots, were it not for a new and exciting option made available to young Thomas courtesy of the recent employment opportunities that had developed in his surrounding region. Although country labour was the most common living on offer, there was now also the chance of peddling buttons around the local area in a trade that had become increasingly popular in recent years thanks to the button production industry found in nearby Macclesfield. There was a danger in that life though, as the reputations of those involved seemed somewhat tainted by the slightly more nefarious inclinations a peddler's life could attract. The emerging silk industry was worth considering too, with Charles Rowe having built the first silk-throwing mill again in Macclesfield in 1743. Such changes in the surrounding area meant that the idea of moving to a new town for employment no longer held quite the same sense of risk that it had in Meekin's parents' youth. There were plenty of success stories out there, but there were still horror stories too. For Thomas, though, perhaps most important in his ultimate decision-making process was his natural aptitude for the maintenance of rural life. He was good with horses. He understood them and had something of a natural affinity. So when the opportunity arose to take the position of stable groom to a wealthy apothecary in the town of Stone, just 16 miles to the south, Thomas and his family knew it was his big chance. Obtaining a position of service was considered an advantageous situation for young men and women in working class society during the 1700s. Whilst not quite the Downton Abbey model, the opportunity to forge something like a livelihood away from the constant hardships of a poorer rural life was not to be sniffed at. And we can safely assume Meekin's parents would have been pleased with the opportunity their son had been given. So it's here we should consider the first part of the story. What exactly was the position obtained? And what exactly was an apothecary? It's always struck me when reading about Meekin's story that there's quite a disconnect at this juncture. A wealthy apothecary with his own stables doesn't hold hands well with the image of the dispensary chemist that Meekin's master is often connected with, and with good reason. Prior to the publication of the first official medical register in 1779, the medical nourishment of 18th century England was a patchwork of duty and care primarily overseen by a system of private enterprise that largely catered only for those who could afford it. The hospitals for the poor established in the earlier centuries were still a going concern, but for both middle class and high society, a more personal process was preferred. At the top of that tree sat surgeons and physicians, with apothecaries just below, offering a range of services to the lower middle class and working population. A solid staple of their business was the creation and sale of their own medicines, manufactured on-site and advertised through attractive storefronts filled with colourful jars. They would supply surgeons and physicians too where they could, but they were more than happy to help anybody that walked in off the street. Skilled chemists, you could perhaps view the 18th century apothecary as something of a continuation in the alchemist tradition, and they wouldn't be subject to regulation until the 1850s. Alongside their role as dispensaries of medication, the apothecary would also be involved in the diagnosis and treatment of all manner of ills amongst those that looked to them for advice and comfort. And of course, the apothecary was a person with ready access to all kinds of potions that may be sold for more recreational adventures too. Aside from the somewhat ad hoc nature of service to a broad range of clientele, apothecaries were on occasion fond of securing more contractually based work for their services, particularly in the realms of the poorhouse. All in all, the level of social status afforded to the local apothecary during Meakin's time, particularly in the provinces, was significant. They were amongst the key figures within local society, and the financial rewards for their work were substantial. The study of apothecary wills has become something of a historical pastime in itself in recent years. That the apothecary in stone should have cause to advertise for a groom for his horses should be no surprise at all. Meakin's master would have undoubtedly been a man of considerable financial means. At the census of 1801, taken just over 20 years from Thomas Meakin's brief spell in the town of Stone is reported to have had a population of some 2,843 souls, 10 times that of Rushton Spencer. Now, the apothecary trade was a competitive and territorial business, and so in such a small community as Stone, it would have been likely that a single master apothecary was present serving both the local population and the more transient passing trade facilitated by the Trent and Mersey Canal. That said, one can't help but wonder how a lad in Rushton came to hear of the opening in Stone in the first place, little more why the apothecary would need to look so far for a suitable applicant. Having located a marriage record of a Mary Meakin and Philip Wright at St. Michael's Church, Stone, in May 1742, and indeed the burial of an Alice Meakin in January 1757, I'm inclined to suggest that the position with the apothecary was made all the more obtainable for Thomas by the presence of relatives living already in the town. At this point, we must defer to the well-known legend of Meakin, for the next phase of his life passes by in the blink of an eye. Meakin is said to have grown close to the daughter of his master, an eventuality which is easy to picture. As an outgoing, confident stranger from the far north of the county, it would make perfect sense for him to attract the attention of the daughter of the house, particularly given his role as stable groom, riding being such a popular cultural pastime for those in a comfortable position, such as the apothecary's daughter. The whole affair wouldn't last, though, as suddenly, aged just 21, Thomas fell mysteriously ill and died. Burial records for St. Michael's in Stone show his burial taking place on the 16th of July, 1781. Often, given the nature of their trade and skill set, the local apothecary will be the most senior official available upon the death of members of the lower classes. As a prominent and trusted community figure, it was a natural assumption that such a person was equipped with all the moral fibre and faculty to preside over declarations, and in all likelihood, it would have been the apothecary who found Meakin's body. As such, there would appear to have been little need for any alternate authority to take charge of the matter. The case of the death of Thomas Meakin, as far as the town of Stone was concerned, was an open and shut case. It was the events that followed across the 12 months from Meakin's death that add the real air of lore to his tale. Some versions of the tale say that it was the pony of Meakin's replacement groom, others that it was Meakin's own favourite pony from the stable yard. But either way, a convergence brings us to the churchyard of St. Michael's, where a pony is reported to have taken to travelling at night alone in order to kick away at the dirt of Meekin's grave. By this time, the affair between Meekin and his master's daughter was well known in the town, and questions as to how such a fit and healthy young man had simply dropped dead were gathering in number. These suspicions, coupled with the uncanny actions of the pony, led to an inevitable turn of events. At some point in the early summer of 1782, the decision was made. Meekin's coffin would be opened up for investigation. A clue as to why there is no formal record of investigation of this action is perhaps born between the lines of the succinct entry in the local parish record that followed. Meekin had turned over inside his coffin, scratch marks scored into the inside of the lid. He had not been dead at the time of burial, merely catatonic, with the local parish record reading, Thomas Meekin of Stone was buried July the 16th, 1781, and was removed hence and buried at Rushton Spencer, July the 17th, 1782. That's it, the total extent of the official record and such a strange and suspicious event. Yet there was little mystery locally as to how this had all come to pass. The apothecary was the sole source of potion and poison in the town, and the ability to induce a catatonic state well within his repertoire. That said, I find it hard to imagine that a live burial was a genuine intention. Rather, determined that his daughter would not take up with a member of the lower classes, I think it more likely he intended to outright kill Meekin by poison. We're probably a little too early for cyanide, with arsenic seemingly the most likely means. The odourless and tasteless properties of organic arsenic compounds, such as arsenic trioxide, made for an ideal poison in the later 18th century, particularly given the fact it would be 1835 before anything like a reliable test for arsenic poisoning was invented. As a recommended treatment for syphilis, Meekin's master was bound to be quite the expert in its administration too, and so, much as with the elixir of death created by an apothecary in Shakespeare's play Romeo and Juliet that leads Romeo to believe Juliet is dead, so passed Thomas Meekin. The issue of the pony at Meekin's grave is a curious one. Horses in general have a long folkloric association with death, from drawing black carriages to a plethora of associated forbidding and otherworldly motifs. I've sometimes wondered whether the presence of the pony in Meekin's tale was a later addition, or indeed a kind of false flag created locally to give a final push in the call for exhumation. The inclusion of a reference to the event in the parish register of St. Michael's, as with the corresponding action taken in Rushton, suggests that the event really did take place. But by whom was it undertaken? The lack of fanfare and outrage in its wake strongly suggests direct local action, with the apothecary being far too powerful a figure to take down in the process. As noted earlier, it's entirely likely that there was just one master apothecary in the town at the time of Meekin's death. If we think of the kind of apothecary with the means to pull off a murder such as Meekin's, the idea of a solitary suspect is perhaps even more convincing. As we look for that suspect, it's interesting to note that Meekin attracts no mention at all in the local historical works created at the time. Reverend Stebbing Shaw was Staffordshire's key historian in the period, and he himself was born in Stone. He was just 2 years junior to Meekin in age, being born in 1762. However, his History and Antiquities of Staffordshire, published in 1802, contains no trace of the story. To me, this suggests the matter had been hushed up sufficiently by the time Shaw compiled his work, as at the time of the event itself, he was away in study at Queen's College, Cambridge. There is one figure, however, that may well fit the bill as a suspect apothecary. Reference is found within the William Salt Library of a Stone apothecary by the name of Dickinson in the year 1790. It didn't feel like much of a connection at first, but tethered to the likelihood of there being a single master apothecary at work in the town at the time, the find took a more meaningful turn when I found this curious mention in the Staffordshire Advertiser of the 13th of September, 1800. Yesterday, an inquest was taken at Stone before J. Dickinson, Gent, on the body of John Robinson, a boatman who was found in his cabin. Verdict, died by visitation of God. This is likely to be one and the same man. That Dickinson is referred to as a gent suggests a man of means, since retired, and by virtue of his position, someone thought capable of oversight in the matter of the medical inquiry, but notably not a man with the formal title of doctor. Such a man is likely an apothecary. Could it be that two men of the same name within the same town, 10 years apart and with the same requisite level of medical knowledge, are in fact the same person? one will be forgiven for assuming it so. And it will be a whole lot easier to get away with the poisoning of someone in late 18th century Staffordshire if, alongside having the ability to create and administer the poison itself, that same person was also in charge of both registering the death and overseeing any potential inquiries that came in the wake of the event. It could well perhaps be called a perfect crime. Thomas Meakin existed, he lived and died, and we know the manner of his death to be extremely contentious. Thomas Meakin has become part man, part legend in local lore, but in honour of there being no doubt as to his tragic death, perhaps our last thought should be for Thomas Meakin to rest in peace, back home atop that gentle hill in Rushton Spencer, looking down on the world below him, unnoticed by the passers-by, the boy who was buried alive, the boy who was buried twice. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find out more about my research into Thomas Meakin in my book, Myth Historic Origins, which is available via my website, thelocalmythstorian.com, and via Amazon worldwide. As always, it's been an absolute pleasure. Until next time.